Ladies and gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us this evening. I'm Robin Niblett, I'm the Executive Vice President of CSIS, and it's my pleasure, especially in John Hamry's absence, our CEO, who's headed off on his first week of Trio or BlackBerry-less vacation in, I reckon, 4 years. Actually, I was talking to one of his staff members today, trying to work it out. But I know he would have liked to have been here, but it's certainly my honor and my pleasure to be able to welcome the Secretary General McKinnon to this to CSIS and to address the topic we have before us, building sustainable democracies the Commonwealth way. The Secretary General has had a distinguished career both within the Commonwealth and within New Zealand politics. I know you have his bio, but I'm still going to, if you don't mind, indulge a little bit because I think it's relevant, especially to the topic at hand that he'll be addressing. He was first elected as Commonwealth Secretary General in 1999. And was then re-elected in December 2003. And he joined the Commonwealth after a 21-year career in New Zealand politics. He was New Zealand's longest-serving foreign minister, foreign minister and trade minister, and held a number of other senior positions there, deputy prime minister, minister of foreign affairs, and also leader of the House of Representatives, and a number of other ministerial posts. Within that capacity, again, was involved in a number of topics which I think are relevant to the discussion today, promoting the deployment of New Zealand peacekeepers in a number of countries, named foreign minister, in fact, of the year by the World Economic Forum, and also was involved in brokering the ceasefire between the Bougainvillians and Papua New Guinea, and received a Nobel Peace Prize nomination for his work there. He has had an active career since he's been in the Commonwealth itself, and I've noted here from his bio a few areas, especially from our perspective at CSIS, his work trying to promote youth programs to prevent HIV/AIDS, an area that my colleague Steve Morrison, Director of our Africa Program, has worked on as well, defending the rights of small states, both within the Commonwealth and beyond, and in particular the area of our discussion today. Working with the Commonwealth and strengthening their work in promoting democratic government, democratic practices, good governance, and respect for human rights. That's the main topic that we're discussing today. We look forward very much to your remarks, Mr. Secretary General. I'll turn it over then to Steve to moderate Q&A. I think we've got till around about 7 o'clock. But thank you very much for joining us, and we look forward to your comments.
Well, thank you very much, Robin, and thank you also for your organization willing to have me here and listen to a few thoughts on, as you say, the subjects that that are of interest to all of us. I'm pleased to see, obviously, a wide range of people, some of whom I've known before, a number of envoys of Commonwealth countries. Your Excellency is always pleased to see you. It's always very pleasing for me to come back to this city. I can say that 50 years ago next month, I graduated from Woodrow Wilson High School. Then I went and spent a lengthy amount of time out in Montana and Wyoming chasing horses and chasing cattle, and was chased by a moose at one stage in the Bighorn Mountains. But growing up in a political town as I was, I was at school with the sons and daughters of congressmen, of senators, of lobbyists, and many, many government workers. So I got used to being in a government town. I'm trying to see people that possibly even older than me here, but I can say that in 1957, I stood in January on Pennsylvania Avenue and watched the Eisenhower inaugural parade. Senator Estes Kefauver was our next-door neighbor in Spring Valley, and three blocks away lived the Vice President Nixon. He didn't need any security in those days. And I naturally, being at Wilson High School, I had to take the required courses in American history and American government, which I still think is a great sort of a civilian building exercise. But I had to ask my father, who is an Army general, who is this Private G. David Shine in the Army McCarthy hearings that's getting so much attention? That was a very dominant feature in those days. I never thought about going into politics, I must say, at that time, but clearly by a process of osmosis, I was absorbing much of this atmosphere, and a combination of concerns for one country and the usual misplaced view that you can actually change the world, I became a political candidate, albeit a very unsuccessful one, But some 9 years later, in 1978, I was successful, which did actually put me on the path to bring me here today. But apart from that, the fact of being able to talk with you here at CSIS is useful because a lot of the work that we do is very similar to what you folks are addressing, the promotion of democracy, global security, economic security, and political stability. You've been a great asset to this country because your strategic counsel is of great importance to the foreign policy of the world's leading power. Looking through your long list of illustrious trustees of this organization, I can say that having met a number of them in my professional life, you are certainly well served by their involvement. But there are just three issues I really do want to talk a little bit about tonight, and they are, of course, democracy, conflict, and cultural understanding. I want to try and see these through the world's prism, not just through the American prism or through the Commonwealth prism, but through that broad aspect. You may not agree with everything I say, obviously, and I have equally no doubt that as Americans or Commonwealth citizens, and between us as global citizens, we can share ways of meeting the many challenges that are in front of us at the present time. Those challenges, I would begin with freedom and democracy. We use the words very easily. They are much heard of in this country and in the Commonwealth. They are certainly our deepest held beliefs. We know what they mean in practice. They do mean a vote and a voice for ordinary citizens. They do mean government of the people and by the people. They do talk about orderly transfer of power. And no matter what people say about what happened in Florida in November 2000, the fact that power could peacefully change hands is something to be absolutely appreciated. It's an extraordinary tribute to what we understand by the term democracy. And I've often said, my own sort of way, is that democracy is having an election, changing a government, and no one actually gets upset about that at the end of the day. Perhaps democracy really starts to bite when the vote is the cue for a government to actually govern through a public sector and a civil service which can turn policy into practice. And after all, that's what governments are elected for, turning policy into practice, hopefully to deliver accountability, efficiency, fairness, transparency, and more. And even the world's most developed countries, its proudest and oldest democracies, are still work in progress. Democracy is not a conclusion. Democracy is not the end of the line. It is a process. And based as I am now in the United Kingdom, I see an almost daily digest of news about the ways that some of the oldest and indeed the best democratic systems in the world are displaying some deficiencies and the need for them to adopt the policy of constant reformation. You have to keep on improving no matter what. And if we have problems with the more mature democracies, no wonder we will always struggle in encouraging other countries to embrace the idea. Countries without the years of painstaking effort, the institutions or the pluralist cultures. Countries that not only want democracy, but the development benefits that are supposed to go with it. And if I'm forgiven a cliche, it's very easy for us in the Commonwealth or you in the US to talk about democracy. It is always a lot harder to walk that talk. Conflict too, of course, if not mercifully the stuff of our daily lives, it's certainly the stuff of our daily television news bulletins. The last 15 years we've seen appalling conflicts in the Balkans and Africa, Afghanistan, Iraq, and even if it is now largely an intra-state conflict rather than a cross-border conflict, it is conflict nonetheless. People dying in a conflict don't appreciate being dying either one way or the other. So look at two facts in Africa. First of all, the good news, because 20 years ago there were some 20 armed conflicts on that continent, while now they can be counted on the fingers of one hand. But on the other hand, you balance that with Africa's forgotten war and the DRC, which has claimed something like 4 million lives since 1998. So if the 20th century saw humankind at its most unkind and destructive, then the 21st century still is problematical and could yet become worse. Whether we like it, this conflict is a fact of our lives. So too are the fact of cultural divides, religious divides, imposed boundaries on countries are the sort of potential new conflict and a real threat to the fabric of the democratic societies in which we have invested so much. So most obviously it's easy in this way to talk about religious extremism and terrorism, but I'm also talking about the racial and ethnic tension that blights so many of our societies. So too referring to an underclass, particularly of young people with no prospects, people who feel alienated, disenfranchised, and at best sullenly indifferent, and at worst deeply resentful of the societies in which they live. And a roll call of those place names from New York to Madrid to London to Paris, from the West Bank to the Caribbean, to from Pakistan to Sri Lanka to Egypt to Indonesia, will leave none of us in any doubt as to what happens when faiths, ethnicities, communities, and nations fail to understand and respect one another. And we know that much of this cultural misunderstanding takes the form of antagonism towards the so-called Western way of life, and particularly the American way of life. And when Danish flags were burnt over the newspaper cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, it was actually a change to see red and white flags burning rather than the stars and stripes. But these are pretty crude sort of introductions to these themes. The simple point is that these are the world's themes. They're not just one particular, but they are and do belong to everybody. And this is where tonight, to be able to talk about the Commonwealth themes, which again, very similar, and try and show you how we in the Commonwealth are responding to them in the way that an international institution of 53 members can. But let me give you that brief portrait through the Commonwealth prison or the Commonwealth itself. 53 nations, 1.8 billion people, from the giant, which of course is India, to tiny Tuvalu in the Pacific Islands with only 11,000 people. One third of the world's population, one quarter of its countries, and nearly a quarter of its trade. We're in the Caribbean, we're in Europe, we're in Africa, Asia, the Pacific. We're the very richest and the very poorest, of every colour, of every creed. Former colonies, dominions, protectorates, trusteeships, we have got them all. But these nations are bound as equals, and they share the fundamental belief in freedom and democracy. Our heads of government meet every 2 years for 3 days, and in that time they assert their convictions, sometimes even taking direct action on a fellow member. At the same time, they give us and the Secretariat, or me, the Chief Executive of the Secretariat, our work priorities for the next couple of years. If you've heard of the British Commonwealth, it died in 1949, something I continue to have to tell many people, especially in the United Kingdom. We were born of an empire, but we've transcended that empire and bound ourselves with the values of freedom and equality. The Commonwealth, in some cases, is the child of Prime Minister Nehru of India, because in 1948, India turned its back on the British monarchy as the head of state and became a republic. But it had no intention of losing its friends and so retained its membership of the Commonwealth, the first republic to do so. Now, of course, we only have 16 Commonwealth countries who see the British monarch as their head of state. All the rest are either republics or, in fact, four other monarchies. The 1949 London Commonwealth Declaration was the result. I do often quote Arnold Smith, the Canadian, who was the first Secretary General, where he said, "The Commonwealth may just prove to be the best and most lasting legacy of that British Empire." So the twin pillars of the Commonwealth are very much democracy and development. And while development is done through a small fund which delivers advice in carefully targeted areas, democracy I will come back to. One can list a lot of things that we do on a very constant basis. Model legislation, because Commonwealth countries all having similar legal structures, one law can very easily be brought into effect and ratified in most Commonwealth countries. Legislation on money laundering, prescription for the recovery of illegal assets, trade advisors supporting WTO negotiations, protocols managing the migration of teachers and nurses, because you've no idea how easy it is for teachers and nurses to be sucked out of the Caribbean, sucked out of Africa, to the United States, to the United Kingdom and elsewhere. And also we have an extraordinary powerful group of people called our Ambassadors for Positive Living. Young people who are HIV positive who go around talking to other young people about how not to become HIV positive. So the Commonwealth's authority does come in several forms. First, of course, is the power of the what I call the combined voice. 53 leaders can resonate strongly on a number of issues. And last time they got together in Malta in November last year, they issued probably the strongest statement on the need for a successful multilateral trade round, the need for a true development round out of the Doha talks. I think one is a little bit more pessimistic now on whether this can happen than what it was last year in December. Secondly is the power of a group of nations who speak the same language, but I do not mean the English language. I mean the language of the institutions. We all understand each other's institutions, our parliaments, our judiciary, our legal systems, our education systems, our health systems, very similar wherever you go. And the third point is the power of giving voice to those who are not often heard. 32 of our 53 members are officially small states. They're all burdened with typical problems: environmental degradation, crime, underdevelopment, isolation, lack of critical mass, and more. But the big thing in the Commonwealth is that the voice of Tuvalu is heard just as loudly as the voice in India. But the small states will always be small states. By treating them on an equal platform doesn't make them grow into big states. They will always be small, they will always be vulnerable, they will always be underendowed. But then lastly, of course, is the power of the family itself. And like any family, cousins, brothers, aunts, uncles, there's always scraps amongst them. But when it comes to joining together, they will always join together if they believe it's for the right purpose at the right time. So that's sort of a bit of a coloration of where we are and what we are. But if we look a little bit more closely at these issues which I did want to spend a bit of time on, democracy, conflict, and cultural understanding. I mentioned elections and the good government they are supposed to bring, because we do spend a lot of time, our secretariat, observing elections in many parts of the Commonwealth. And we've certainly observed, I think, over 40 or 50 already. We don't just observe the elections, we make a report on the electoral process after those elections have been held, and often before the results of the elections actually come out, so we can say what was good and what was bad. And where we can, we then can get alongside the government and talk about what needs to be done, where there wasn't clear transparency, where the ballot boxes weren't exposed to the people to see them, and all those things like that. So we can make a lot of use of those efforts after an election to ensure the next one will be better. In 1991, the Commonwealth made an explicit statement of its core underlying principles of democracy, human rights, the rule of law, judicial independence, gender equality, just and honest government, and, importantly for our poorer countries, sustainable development. The Commonwealth's determination to deal robustly with serious or persistent violations of democracy within its membership was the next stage, and I can still say we are the only international organization that has a group of foreign ministers who are the police, the judge, and the jury in terms of dealing with any of our members who fail to live up to the expectations, who violate the principles of the Commonwealth. And so was set up what we call the Commonwealth Ministerial Action Group. Made up from members of the Commonwealth, a group of usually 9 foreign ministers whose membership changes a little bit every 2 years, have the power to suspend a member from the councils of the Commonwealth. And past experience shows that they have been quite willing to do so. And having been involved in that as a minister, I can say that no country likes to be suspended from the Commonwealth, no matter what they say after the suspension. And it's then they make a determined effort to come back into the Commonwealth, and we've seen that a number of times. With one exception, of course, was Zimbabwe, which, having been suspended from the Commonwealth and then the suspension confirmed by the leaders, then said, well, we are leaving the Commonwealth. Well, that was a sad day in many ways for us because we didn't want to leave Zimbabwe. On the other hand, it showed that our principles were above what one member could violate. And hence, I hope someday they do come back to the Commonwealth. The ball is in Zimbabwe's court. CMAG, therefore, has been something of a success because in Nigeria, the suspension was followed by a return to democracy, likewise in Fiji and in Sierra Leone, where there were unconstitutional breaches in governance, and after a great deal of effort, they did return to democracy and order. It's always been something, say, amusing to me, but after every suspension, the country is suspended, tells the whole world that the Commonwealth was the worst organization they ever belonged to. Why they belong, they're not too sure, but they never intend to go back. And always within 6 months, the dialogue begins, and usually within a couple of years, they come back again and are very pleased to do so. Pakistan, of course, was suspended from the Commonwealth when the then General Musharraf staged a military coup. It might have been a very nice coup. It might have been a bloodless coup. There may not have been any shots fired in anger, but the fact was he tipped out a democratically elected government, which I know everyone says was the most unpopular democratic government elected anyway. But the fact was that after that suspension, we were actively engaged with Pakistan. We encouraged them over and lead up to the 2002 elections. I think at our behest, they produced a roadmap up until those elections, and they've always shown a lot of consideration for that dialogue. It is an important Islamic state, and the progress that they have made, functioning legislatures, a broader representational group of people in those legislatures and in the provinces, and generally more accountability in the fight against corruption. But, and I can only say the glass is more than half full in that particular case, but there are still other issues that have to be resolved because President Musharraf is still the operational commander of the armed forces. And to be the president and the operational commander of the armed forces is, and I quote from 53 Commonwealth leaders, and including the Pakistan Prime Minister at that meeting, that is incompatible with the basic principles of democracy and the spirit of the Harare Commonwealth Declaration. So Pakistan, in all this, has shown regard for the Commonwealth membership. It doesn't want to leave the Commonwealth. It wants to continue to engage, and it is prepared to listen to what others are saying about those issues. And by the role of the foreign ministers and their review and monitoring, we are certainly working towards that active return or active involvement to a return to full democracy in Pakistan today. So the Commonwealth Ministerial Action Group in that case does work with the endorsement of a quarter of the world's leaders with their blessing, so to speak. But the meetings that our leaders have, and I think this is one of the truly great strengths of the Commonwealth as an organization, when the leaders meet, it is incredibly informal. They are always very direct. And it was Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau who in 1971 got the Commonwealth heads of government to agree that they would never come to a meeting with a prepared speech. Nor would they come with a lot of civil servants. Some of them have breached that last one in more recent times. But that's where what the retreat component of the heads of government was invented, when the heads of government go off on their own and really deal very directly with the issues at hand without their officials and without anyone else there. 53 leaders. In fact, I'm the 54th one in the room, so I can tell you it is a very useful kind of debate. Now, I was very sad to read that in the G8 leaders, the time in their retreat is now down to about 45 minutes. And all I can read into that is the officials are slowly winning their way. But like many other, it was an APEC, and I was one of the early ministers through the APEC period. We did exactly the same thing there when the leaders, when it was President Clinton who introduced the leaders into the APEC process of having the leaders to sit around on their own. And I can tell you they make more progress on their own than when they're kind of held back by minister. This is really the official line, not the one you're expounding. So the accent is on the engagement of the political leaders to have them determine policy, give them a stake in the interest and the joint decisions of the association. And, of course, because they're in a room on their own, because they're not recorded, it's a high incentive for them to keep their word on that matter. Another important activity, which, of course, that is directed towards the creation and maintenance of sustainable democracies, is what we call the Secretary General's good officer's role, where as Secretary General I can appoint someone as a special envoy through the ability to get to another leader in a way that it will not be rejected by another leader. And I'm sure all of you realize that leaders, no matter who, no matter where, do not like being told publicly how deficient they are, or what they need to do, or what they should do, or how they should improve their governance. They will invariably retaliate even more strongly. But what we do find is that when I can appoint a special envoy, usually a former president or a former prime minister or a former foreign minister, to engage with a leader, to encourage them to another course of action, it does, in fact, bear fruit. It is not done publicly. It is done out of sight, certainly for a while anyway, until you feel you're making some kind of progress. But you're always dealing with actually very sensitive situations. And we do find that leaders are prepared to grant access to that sort of person because they come from the Commonwealth. They don't represent New Zealand. They don't represent Canada. They don't represent Samoa. They don't represent Trinidad or India or Pakistan. They just represent that broad neutrality of the Commonwealth, and therefore they are welcomed and listened to. We cannot command an army or a navy or an air force to do what we want a country to do. It is only by influence and the force of the 53 other countries saying this should happen that usually causes those change. Friendly pressure, I can say, does work. A lot of work can be done before any of the options of sanctions or military action can be called upon. So it's in the nature of good officers that despite some impressive triumphs, the benefits of the work are largely unsung and will probably remain so. But I can tell you that we have deployed good officers in the last couple of years in the Cameroon, in the Gambia, in Guyana, Kenya, Swaziland, Tonga, and the Maldives. And one example from a few years ago, which was the good officers in Tanzania, the Mwafaka Agreement between the mainland Tanzanian government and the island of Zanzibar, where we are still involved. And no doubt the shared experience of building democracy is very much behind the decision of new states to want to seek membership of the Commonwealth. The last two members to join were Cameroon and Mozambique. And of course, I can usually find very few people who can tell us which of the five former German colonies that are part of the Commonwealth. But we also now have interested parties in the form of Algeria, Rwanda, Yemen, to name a few, who are interested in joining the Commonwealth along with Palestine and Israel. So clearly this is an issue which we in the Commonwealth now have to address, having not had new members since 1995, and our leaders will be reviewing this issue at their next meeting in Kampala in Uganda, November next year. But that said, the history has shown us again and again that economic prosperity is just as important as the pursuit of democracy. It's a guiding Commonwealth principle that democracy and development are inextricably linked very closely. In fact, if any of you wish to contact us, there's a wonderful publication which we commissioned a couple of years ago where I got a group of very eminent Commonwealth leaders, commercial, academic, political leaders, chaired by a former Indian finance minister who happens to be now the Indian Prime Minister, firmly linking democracy and development. And everything they said in that publication showed you cannot separate those two. And it's a very good sort of Bible for those who are travelling around developing countries and hear, as I've heard many times, "Don, we can't eat democracy." You may not be able to eat democracy, but if you've got development without democracy, it will not last. And if you've got democracy and you continue to build those democratic institutions, you will encourage development. You encourage confidence, and you bring those two together. But one area, of course, that we are very concerned about is this whole issue of development that can come from more open trade. And as one who has been very supportive of the Doha development round, and I say so because I've been a minister coming through the Uruguay round, and remembering at the end of the Uruguay round, everyone said, "Yep, next time we will fix up agriculture. Next time we'll fix those trade barriers, agriculture subsidies. Next round will be the one." Well, the next round is here. Doha is with us. And up until Hong Kong, I was very optimistic that something would come of it. Now I have to remain quite pessimistic that little is going to come out of the Doha round for developing countries. Yet it is the one thing that could bring so many developing countries out of poverty is free access into the United States, into Europe, into Japan. And when that'll happen, you will see literally millions of people taken out of poverty. And I'm not just saying that lightly. The World Bank, the IMF can say, if agriculture trade barriers drop tomorrow, 160 million people could be taken out of poverty. That is a lot of people. So we do still want to see. I had a very good meeting this afternoon with Paul Wolfowitz of the World Bank and Vice President Cheney. And I made the point, obviously, this is one area where the United States can still play a few more cards, put more pressure on Europe, put more pressure on yourselves here in the United States to get something out of this Doha round that developing countries can see, will get some benefit from. I've given the little speech about cotton subsidies around the Commonwealth probably too often, but as long as there's something like $4 billion being paid out in cotton subsidies here in the United States, you keep in poverty cotton growers in Ghana, in Nigeria, in Kenya, and Uganda. And that is actually not a very good thing. So we need development because we can't eat democracy. So too we need harmony and a true spirit of democracy. So if our treasured elections and our institutions are to have any meaning, that must happen. There is, of course, and I bring this more of a final point here, the issue of disharmony in our societies, because we don't like the tensions and levels of misunderstanding which society does have today. Dialogue, understanding, and goodwill at any level and between any protagonists are the only solutions to the ills of chauvinism and extremism. The alienation that breeds violence has many roots: religion, language, ethnicity, money, culture, poverty, illiteracy, environmental degradation, and political injustice. All can be apparent of that alienation. And luckily, the Commonwealth has been dealing with such problems for a long time. In fact, it was Nelson Mandela who said in 1994, the Commonwealth makes the world safe for diversity, because we are a remarkable melting pot of linguistic, religious, cultural, and ethnic groups, and so many of our individual members. So we've got to put this valuable resource to use. And that's why our heads of government in Malta last year asked me to look at ways in which the Commonwealth can make a real contribution to the international efforts to promote cross-cultural dialogue, and also at how it can use best practice, because a lot of our countries are doing it all the time, where there are those multiplicity of groups within the countries. How do you find practical ways? We're in the process of setting up a task force in each of the Commonwealth ministerial meetings this year, and I've just come from our Commonwealth Youth Ministers meeting in the Bahamas. Our finance ministers are going to be meeting in Sri Lanka. Our foreign ministers meet in New York. Our education ministers will be meeting in South Africa, wanting them to bring their thoughts. So it's not just a sort of a foreign policy thing. It becomes very holistic. How can it be enhanced so that we can go to our heads of government when they meet in Uganda towards the end of 07 and try and lift this debate so that others can see within countries, within communities, even within families, where these tensions can rise, what best can be done. So trying to sort of wrap up this broad sort of picture I've been painting for you, I go back to my own links with the United States. Clearly, wherever one is as a teenager, it does have quite an influence on one's thinking. Certainly a country that I have a deep bond with, but it's always going to be a country that has a multiplicity of pressures because it is the world's only superpower. Within the 53-nation Commonwealth, the United States has many allies. And as I said today, I've had some very productive discussions with senior members of the administration and others like over at the World Bank. So there's good cooperation. And also with the two offshoots of the political parties, the NDI and the IRI, whom we work with on election observation and growing of democratic institutions and such things like that. I know that the United States has some uneasy relationships with some Commonwealth countries. We know that the issue of Iraq, the issue of trade, and the UN can be very sensitive and divisive issues. But I guess I'm trying to say here the challenges of democracy, conflict, and promoting understanding are certainly challenges for us all. Hopefully, I've been able to sort of show how we in the Commonwealth go about meeting each of those, whether it's on diversity, whether it's on democracy, whether it's on economic issues or development issues. I think what we can say, and I'm coming back to the subtext of what I was saying, the foreign policy of the world's leading power, is essentially the way that one country, the United States, relates with the world. But it is also how 53 countries of the Commonwealth relate with each other and with the world. We are certainly not a perfect international organization, but we do adhere to those principles of open debate and consensus because they are extraordinarily powerful bonds which do bind us. One little story to conclude with was some 20 years ago, a very poorly briefed Prime Minister was asked after visiting a Commonwealth envoy whether the United States and Japan were members of the Commonwealth. Back came the reply, "The Americans left the Commonwealth 200 years ago, and an American general made sure the Japanese never joined." Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very eloquent and compelling presentation. There's a big debate emerging here in Washington around, within the center, around the whole question of soft power and strategies beyond or separate from military might and in advancing many of these goals. And it's just interesting hearing your discussion around the Commonwealth and the strategies that there is a lot to be learned. There's a lot that can help, from your experience, feed the debate that's emerging here around where do we go forward in this next phase. We've got a lot of talent in this room from many different places in Washington. What I suggest we do is open up with a series of comments and questions and then come back to you. We've got perhaps 20 or 30 minutes for discussion, then we can break for a reception that you're all invited to afterwards, and we can continue in a more informal way the discussion after that. So if you don't have a chance to actually get your comment or question in, just push to the front of the bar in a few minutes. Please identify yourselves with your affiliation for the purposes of our guest here. So who would like to open up? Yes, please.
Sam Rosemary, Institute for National Strategic Studies.
Thank you. My question is, or comment is more about wondering sort of how the Commonwealth looks at building democracies to second and third tier democracies, sort of going beyond just, you know, democratic elections to free and fair. Or I know that, you know, there's only two or so countries in Africa that sort of meet the Freedom House rankings of a two or higher, and that many of the countries, you know, such as Nigeria and others are considered some of the more corrupt countries in the world that are part of the Commonwealth. And I was just sort of wondering what the Commonwealth, what actions they do. You know, they're in the Commonwealth, but how do they encourage these countries that are in the Commonwealth to become a better democracy rather than just a democracy in general?
Hi, Mr. Secretary General. I'm Derek Sparks. I work for Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma on foreign policy issues. And the Senate's going to be soon tasked with the U.S.-India nuclear pact. And this is going to be an issue that's going to seize everyone's attention. There's a lot of disparate views. I might commend to your attention the Senator Nunn, editorial in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, which I think hit the nail right on the head personally. But I was curious about the Commonwealth's opinion. I know you've got disparate membership, you've got a lot of different viewpoints, but you know, the U.S. and India working on this while at the same time, almost at cross purposes, working with the Iranians and North Koreans trying to hold them at bay on nuclear proliferation issues. And I was curious if this is seen as a double standard in the Commonwealth, or if it's viewed favorably or negatively. So thanks.
Thank you. Pauline?
We're right behind you. Pauline Baker from the Fund for Peace. You mentioned your work in observing elections, and I think that the Commonwealth has gotten quite a good reputation on that, not just in the scope but the depth of it. And I've been an election observer and saw how good the Commonwealth was. I think the problem that we all face now in election observations is that people go to watch elections, they point out all the flaws, and then the host government just ignores it all and does the same thing again, and we all send election observers back again. What is the value of that if it just keeps going on? Is there some sort of thinking within the Commonwealth of not sending elections because the recommendations have not been complied with, and so you just have repeat flawed elections? How can you make more of that tool?
Thank you. Jerry Hyman. I'm the director of the Office of Democracy and Governance at U.S. Agency for International Development. Thank you for discussion and, as Steve said, eloquence. Some people argue that the United States is not right now at the zenith of its popularity around the world. Without condemning the Commonwealth's activities, I wonder if you could suggest possible ways in which the Commonwealth could help us in our democracy promotions, not necessarily in some overt way, but are there divisions of labor in which the 53 members of the Commonwealth could advance this program in ways that we probably cannot or have more difficulty?
Winston Packer, I work for the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee. Pardon me if you mentioned this in your remarks before I arrived. I'm sorry. Our appropriations bill is on the floor this afternoon. What can the Commonwealth do to influence a country such as Zimbabwe in its single-handed, you know, responsibility, the president's responsibility for declining the economy and the overall security and economic security in the country? Thank you.
No, that was a very very comprehensive range of questions there, and you know, I think they're certainly the ones that we're all asking each other. Sam, who raised the question about the second and third tier activities, this to us is very important. I think for a long time, you know, there was a feeling that once you've had an election, fine, go home. But you know, for us, an election is just one aspect alone. It is really just one thing that happens on one day. And more important to us is what was happening before the election. Was there a real determination to get people on the electoral roll and get all people eligible onto a roll of integrity and making sure they're able to vote on the day? I think the next most important thing is that the result of the election, that everyone in the country feels that somehow they are represented. Now, it might not be the person you wanted to represent you, but if by virtue of an election you exclude a religious group or you exclude a racial group or even a tribal group, if they just get completely excluded, you have not succeeded. It's incumbent upon any country devising an electoral system to make sure that somehow everyone does feel represented. So if you have a truly representative assembly, you actually solve a lot of your problems. But from there, you know, is your executive independent of your assembly? Is your judiciary independent of both of those? Do you have reasonably transparent public accounts? Do you have a human rights organization? Now, I don't say that every country must have a human rights organization. It's a stage of development, but it should be one of those institutions that you're working towards. So it is not, you know, it is building those institutions all the way, and the election is just one of them. Now, all of our members are at different stages in the process. My friends in the United Kingdom like to say, well, look, we've reached the destination, you know. But even they are talking about how to revamp the House of Lords, which would be the least democratic institution in the world. So, you know, it continues to be a process. And that, might I also say, six elections in Commonwealth Africa in recent times, a president was changed and there was no bloodshed in the street. That was not happening 10 years ago. So we see all these as quite significant changes, and I'm prepared to say often that Commonwealth Africa is actually in pretty good shape in democratic terms. Derek raised the India-US nuclear. As a foreign minister, of course, I had to growl very heavily when India became a nuclear power, and, you know, Pakistan a week later. I think the United States has recognized that India is a true democracy, and you generally can have more faith in a true democracy being a nuclear power than not a true democracy, which you do not see really in North Korea, or nor do you see it in Iran. So, no, I don't really see double standards here, but I would take anything that Sam Nunn writes quite seriously, so I better read that the editorial piece. Pauline, the issue of election observation. To us, election observation is often the means of following up after that. Because all of our election observers, when they write a report, it's their report. It's not my report, it's their report. And if a leader says to me, why do those nasty people say things? I say, well, you know, they're an independent body. They were appointed by me. And the head of our election observer group is always someone who's got status, political status, and will have political status in the country they go to. So we will use that and to go back and say, all right, this is what they said. How can we help you make changes? And by and large, we do get those changes. If it's a deficiency in the enrollment procedure, we can point out ways they can have better enrollment, and we can put them in, you know, get the right people there. If it's deficiency of the election day itself, if it's any one of those deficiency, we use that as a means of getting engaged to promote change. And I believe we can say we're probably 70% successful in getting change. If we point out, you know, 10 deficiencies in an election, I can usually say that by the following election, 7 of them have been resolved. So it's a matter of keeping at it, not sort of... I don't think we've reached the stage of saying, well, it's going to be so bad, we're not going to be there. What I've tried to say, because we get a lot of requests to observe elections, and I have to turn down a lot because we just logistically cannot do it. And I'm trying to say that when we say we can't come, that should be a good housekeeping seal of approval. We actually believe you can have a good election. It hasn't always been correct, I'm sorry, but it has. U.S. popularity. Well, for all my affection for the United States, as long as you are the world's only superpower, you will have a lot of people just want to hate you and love to hate you and want to tell people daily that they hate you, which is an appalling thing, but it's a fact of life, and it's not going to change very much. But I can say that from the regular discussions that I have with State Department, say, and the White House today with the NDI and the IRI, we do a lot with those organizations. Knowing what, you know, your current Assistant Secretary of State for Africa is saying about a number of African nations coincides with our thinking, and therefore we can work together on a number of projects. I mean, you are the bigger partner always, but we can often bring a sort of a neutrality to it. For instance, on another aspect, we're doing a lot of work in Cameroon. That is principally funded by one Commonwealth country. But that Commonwealth country knows that we can achieve very much the same objective as what they want. But it's more likely to be achieved under a Commonwealth flag than under the persuasiveness of one country. So that cooperation, I would hope, can continue. No one can ignore the impact of the United States anywhere in the world today. And hence, that's, you know, one of the very reasons that, for me, the Commonwealth must have a level of engagement in those areas where we do bump into each other quite regularly. On the issue of Zimbabwe, that's the hardest one we've had to deal with. And from the time that I was Secretary General, I was, right in the middle of this. And I've got to say, everything we tried did not succeed. We had two election observer groups there, and they were good election observers. They were all highly qualified people. In fact, the majority of our election observers in two elections were African people or Afro-Caribbean people. The head of our observer group was a former African president. Both those observer teams pointed out real deficiencies in those elections. In both cases, the President Mugabe said he would take heed of those observations. He did not. No change occurred. I tried to send a special envoy, rejected. I tried to send Commonwealth foreign ministers, rejected. I think everyone sort of almost got tired out in the end. One time I spoke to Kofi Annan about a Zimbabwe issue, and his comment was, "Don, I've given up. I've got more things to do than bash my head against a brick wall." And so my a couple of years ago, when we're reaching the end of the line of not making any change. And I can say that given all those that have tried to see change in Zimbabwe, the United States, the United Kingdom, the UN, the World Bank, the IMF, the Commonwealth, no one has done anything to affect any change whatsoever there. So all I can say to you is we deserve an A for effort, but you can give us a D- for achievement.
You know, the Commonwealth exertion on Zimbabwe is quite impressive, and I think you deserve a lot of credit for that, even if it proved to be ineffectual up to now. My question on Zimbabwe is, okay, they've exited, they've said they're pulling themselves out, but there are indications emerging now that as the country really hits the pavement in terms of economics and export of its population and the like, of a reassessment that's going on within the UN, within the region, some of the recent sort of discussions between Mbeki and Kofi Annan and others. How do you see, if things begin to open as a way for a negotiation, how do you see the Commonwealth positioning itself in a situation yeah. like that?
Well, you know, we'd want to be positioned in order to assist. And we did begin to assist at one time with the land redistribution. We started doing work with UNDP on this. But in the end, it was so chaotic. The UN said they were pulling out, and we just had to leave at the same time. I think one great advantage we have as an organization, we're only 300 people working in London. We've got 100 consultants at any one time working in different places. We are fairly fast on our feet. We can move really fairly rapidly on policy change, and we would do so. I'm not convinced that President Mugabe particularly wants to dialogue with the Commonwealth now. I'm sure he doesn't want to dialogue with me for a while, and we may have to see something of a sea change. I would have thought that by now that they would have hit the pavement, but you've probably got to ask yourself, well, who is funding them? Where is the money coming from that got them an IMF bailout? Because those sort of things have assisted the current government to continue. Had it not happened, other things might have happened. So I think probably there's still some way to go, which is very sad because more people are dying than have to die, more people are starving than have to starve, and the neighbours are feeling it. There's not a southern African leader who hasn't publicly criticized Zimbabwe or its president at least once. But they don't like to repeat it. They don't like to megaphone it too much, but they've all been in print at one time because of the impact it's having on their country. President Mbeki says he's got 3 million Zimbabweans in South Africa now. Mozambique's got 500,000. Botswana's always got 300,000 or 400,000. So it's a real problem in the region, and the region is struggling to deal with it.
Eugene Foley, Foley and Associates. What do you do? What does the Commonwealth do when two of its members have a dispute against each other? For instance, Pakistan and India.
My area of study is the countries emerging from the Soviet Union. There's some stunning successes in democracy and development in that group, just as there are stunning failures. Similarly, in the Commonwealth over the years, there have been stunning successes and stunning failures, and the Commonwealth's been at it a bit longer than 15 years. Can you share some thoughts on the reasons for the successes of some and the failures of the others in both areas?
David Throop, senior associate here at CSIS. I'd like to ask you a slightly problematic question about Uganda. Things here, or the assessment of Uganda here, is becoming increasingly critical, and I think that's equally true in London. And yet the Commonwealth not only has President Museveni as the host of the next CHOGM, but the Deputy Secretary General is former Secretary to the Ugandan Cabinet. Does that cause problems in terms of the Commonwealth's response to the process of democratization and the last elections in Uganda?
Sorry. We're a little bit all over the map here, but I wanted to go to the question of health personnel, and it goes a little bit to the disparity of interests within the Commonwealth. Obviously, United Kingdom is a big recipient of nurses, health professionals coming from many of the Commonwealth less developed countries. Just been a big article in the New York Times about upcoming shortages in the U.S. in health personnel. I'm just wondering if you can say a little bit about the protocol that you did develop, what went into that, how binding is it, can it serve as a model elsewhere, perhaps?
George Foyle, International Republican Institute. An observation and a question. I mean, there was Jerry Hyman referred to sort of a general theme of cooperation and how the United States can be helped, if you will. I'm rephrasing your question, but clearly the Commonwealth has a convening capability, which is quite useful, but also can go further in terms of the implementation of international standards. Your organization is sponsoring a meeting next week in London related to the issue of election observation standards, and a number of international NGO organizations, including ours and NDI and others, who are engaged in that. And that's a very helpful issue, which sort of cuts across not only the membership of the Commonwealth, but obviously other institutions and countries that are interested in this process. My question relates to your brief reference to what would be an expansion of the natural constituency of the Commonwealth, Mozambique, Algeria, which is an intriguing question, and obviously I'd be interested in maybe a brief little summary of what is in fact the potential basis for the expansion of the Commonwealth to that kind of country, which clearly has, I think, no clear historical relationship to the core of the constituency, the Commonwealth constituency.
I've got a really broad question, but as you did challenge us at the beginning to think a little bit about cultural divides before you talked about democracy, I wanted to just raise an issue that pulls those two issues together, and that's to do with the rise of what might be called political Islam, where we see elections of parties that, while using the democratic process to become elected, maybe have a different idea of what democracy means in the long term and what it is that makes you legitimate to be a leader, and whether this is something you're concerned about, if you are. Just any insights you might have on that question.
That is probably the most challenging one. Well, Eugene's question on the India-Pakistan dispute, what do we do when two Commonwealth member countries? Well, of course, we try and mediate or help them negotiate or arbitrate or something like that. The case of India and Pakistan, of course, has been a long-standing one. Pakistan has always wanted to internationalize the issue of Kashmir. India has never wanted to internationalize that issue. The Commonwealth, we can only really intervene productively if we are supported in that role by both parties. We would not achieve anything if we were to say, you must come and sit down at this table, you two, and I will talk to you about it. Yes, I've had discussions with a number of Pakistan foreign ministers, a number of Indian foreign ministers, and India's stance has always been, no, we do not want the Commonwealth. We don't want to internationalize this. We don't want to bring any party. Even though I can say that, you know, in the last, well, up until about a year ago, there were many people sort of talking to both India and Pakistan about Kashmir. So that particular one is something that we have just not made any progress on, but on the other hand, when one party just doesn't want us to be involved, we could be wasting a lot of time. So, yeah, there have been sort of overtures to try and help, but it hasn't actually achieved anything. If it is to happen, anywhere in the Commonwealth, putting aside India and Pakistan, yes, we would try and do something where we could, and it has happened in some cases. Not what I call, bellicose kind of activity, but just when there's clearly a tension building up. It's happened in the Caribbean a little bit sometimes. One of the sensitive issues now for many countries, of course, is your maritime boundary. Oil prices being what they are, maritime boundaries have created a high level of importance. And when the other country nearest you across the sea is a Commonwealth country, you are going to come head to head on where that maritime boundary is. So we have done quite a lot of work on the issue of maritime boundaries. And probably more particularly when it's a little Commonwealth country versus a big non-Commonwealth country. And again, Caribbean versus Venezuela and those places. So we do, obviously, are willing to involve ourselves. Success or failure, what are successes or what are failures? They are many and varied. And I would only come back to my sort of little recipe of have you done this, have you done this, have you done this sort of thing. And I think in many of the Central Asian republics, the ability to have an election and the election produce a broadly representative assembly has been very limited in some places. And if that's the starting point, your chances of success are very limited. I mean, you see, in some African countries, Zimbabwe is probably a case where you get one very large tribal group and one smaller tribal group, and there will always be tension politically between those two. In Tanzania, there is a multiplicity of tribes, and it doesn't create quite the same problem as a large tribe and a small tribe. So, but one could only look through that. You know, what I'm talking about is it broadly representative? Is the executive quite separate? Is the legislature got real powers? And from what I read of the Central Asian republics, they are a pretty mixed bag of results. David, on Uganda, this is a very interesting one, and I can say candidly that when President Museveni came to the CHOGM, the heads of government meeting in Malta last year, he got a real shock. Because the opposition leader had just been jailed. And obviously the question was, well, what's this leader doing here when he's jailed as opposition leader? And I give President Museveni his dues. He went straight to the media and fronted it head on and explained what was happening, explained the structure of how this would be dealt with. Most people were prepared to say that the judiciary in Uganda was above political pressure, and they would obviously see it through. Now that President Museveni is looking at hosting the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, I can tell you candidly he wants to have a successful meeting. And to have a successful meeting is not just to have the meeting, but it's to make sure all the right people attend. And for the right people to attend that meeting, he knows there's a number of things that he would wish to tidy up domestically. And I can say that he is going about that. He doesn't want a situation, obviously, where people just refuse to come because some aspects of his governance seem to be anti-democratic. He's a person who always takes things head on. We have given him credit for the fact that he did introduce multi-party democracy, which Uganda had not had. And to some extent, that sort of lessened the charge against the third term or the no restrictive terms. There were 31 constitutional changes that were made with the consent of a reasonably freely elected legislature. So there are times when you have to say, well, it might not be what we wanted, but that's what the people's representatives wanted. Excuse me. Jennifer, on the health protocols, very difficult. We introduced this... excuse me, I'm talking too much. If I can. If not, one of my staff will give you the answer. Amitav, you can while I clear my voice. You know them enough. The health protocols.
We have a health protocol that is not binding. It's not a legal instrument, but it is certainly a politically agreed document, and it has a strong moral suasion. We have brought to a high public profile the issue of nurses and health workers that are leaving poor countries in Africa, in the Caribbean, for employment in the United Kingdom, in the United States, and in Europe. These countries that are employing them obviously are a little bit on the back foot. They say that governments themselves cannot solve this problem because the private sector does a lot of this recruitment. But nevertheless, I think it has put them on the defensive, and certainly over the next few years, I think we will see a change in terms of some more stringent regulations that will be brought into legislations to try and govern the way in which what is effectively referred to as poaching, that is the term that is increasingly being used, will be dealt with. Our health ministers have met just this last weekend in Geneva. They meet every year on the eve of the World Health Assembly. I think this was one of the minor items on the agenda this time, because each year there is a special theme, and this year it was something slightly different. We've just got to watch the results, but it's not a legal instrument as such.
I think, in fact, the World Health Body is looking at actually adopting that Commonwealth Protocol. Mm-hmm. So it won't be legally binding. It's hopefully persuasively binding, but it is an issue that I think people like the United States should address more comprehensively. One thought we had, and it came from one of our people who nearly had it. The Canadians were going to do something. In other words, Canada sets up a nursing school in Jamaica and, trains nurses for Canada from Jamaica. So not therefore. So you've got two nursing schools in Jamaica, one by Jamaica for Jamaica and the other one by Canada for. And there's probably something in that. And John Howard in Australia is looking at doing training schemes in Australia for Pacific Islanders to train people up to. So you're building the overall mass of trained people rather than just moving them around from one place to another. And the same applies to teachers. George, on membership, you're right. Commonwealth leaders confirmed some 10 years ago that membership principally was a long association with a Commonwealth country. And actually Mozambique fitted that, because when the Portuguese left Mozambique, it was only Commonwealth countries that really looked after Mozambique, and there was far more Commonwealth investment in Mozambique than from anyone else for a long period of time. But they then froze the issue of membership, and I think what they'll be looking at now is, do you continue with that sort of criteria that you have a long-term association with a Commonwealth country? Or going to the other side, you could say, well, can you tick all these boxes? And if you can tick all the boxes, well, why shouldn't you, sort of thing? But then people come back to say, but does that, bring in elements that become somewhat alien to your thinking? And even having Cameroon, we realize that Cameroon having a very francophone background, you often bump into real problems there, because they just do not see things the same way as those that have the more Anglo institutions. So, and the other side of it is, should we look at, say, observer status or associate membership or something like that? And there's a whole other states within states, territories of the UK, territories of New Zealand, Australia, who are broadly within the Commonwealth family but don't have the same status as a sovereign state. They participate in a lot of our activities. Should their status be looked at too? So very much an open book. Robin raised the question of this. This is the tough one. I you know, having given talks in places like Pakistan and Bangladesh recently, there's a real feeling that there's something gone badly out of control, and one can only hope that there's a lot of people with goodwill who want to pull back off those extremes. When you talk to young Pakistanis, as I did last year, they are incredibly embarrassed about the extremism that is so prevalent in parts of their country, and I genuinely believe they want to do something about it, and that they are the one people that can do something about it. And I think there was a wonderful example in the Malaysian elections April a couple of years ago, when for all the criticism Dr. Mahathir got as Prime Minister, what he did create was a very large Malaysian middle class. And those elections totally marginalized any extreme group. So there's a real link, you know, between economic growth and poverty and extremism.
Thank you so much. On behalf of everyone here, I want to thank you. This has really been a rich and wonderful discussion. I'd welcome everyone to join us for a few minutes afterwards. And on behalf of everyone, thank you very much.